Hi, I'm Michael Feinstein. My guest today is vocalist Catherine Russell. She grew up in a musical family with a father who was the musical director for Louis Armstrong. She started her career singing in clubs as a backup singer for Paul Simon, Steely Dan, and David Bowie, among many others. In 2006, she broke out into a solo career with the release of her debut album, Cat. And she has emerged as an exciting interpreter of the great American songbook. Catherine Russell, welcome to Song Travels.
Thank you, Michael.
I'm so happy to have you on this program because we've known each other for a few years now.
Yes, several years.
Yeah, more than a few. And I've had the great joy of working with you.
Well, I am so happy to be here, and I've really been looking forward to this. So I really appreciate you having me on.
Oh, well, it's a pleasure. I've loved seeing what's happened with your career over the last few years, the last several years, because you have a kind of a voice that is absolutely distinctive, and it's a voice that is so gratifying to listen to. It's just caressing. It reminds me of the way I used to feel caressed by Rosemary Clooney.
That's a high compliment. I never got to hear her live, you know, but I was such a great fan of her interpretation of song all these years. She's really, you know, one of my role models as far as telling the story. So you could have heard a song a million times, and then you hear Rosemary Clooney sing it, and it's like the first time. She definitely caresses you.
That's how I've always felt about her lyrically. I know that you come from a musical background, and I want to get to that, but when did you start really connecting with lyrics in a deep way?
As far as performing, I think that during the course of my growth as a solo artist, you know, I think that has given me the confidence to actually share the lyric with people, because I try to choose songs that I can live through, you know, so they just help me. And I've always grown up listening to people that I think connect incredibly with lyric, Frank Sinatra, Peggy Lee, Rosemary Clooney. I mean, these are people that I grew up listening to, and I would think, gee, they're just coming right out of the radio, you know, at me. So it's always inspiring to me.
And you have this deep connection with jazz and blues that in some cases is not about the lyric.
I like things that make you dance, you know, things that swing. So I always, too, like the rhythm and blues period, you know, the end of the 40s into the 50s when the big band era was on the decline, really, and people were just trying to hold some kind of band together with horns, you know, and the music kind of became a lot simpler, but it was, people were still dancing to it. So it was kind of that funny period there, the pre-rock and roll, you know, where people were still coming together on the dance floor. So not so harmonically complex at all, but fun to listen to. So a lot more blues in that. So, you know, that's why I just enjoy, because it's fun to listen to.
Absolutely. Well, you have a talent for finding songs that sometimes fulfill both. For example, there's a song I'd love to ask you to sing that was written by Irving Berlin that is a musical theater song. It's a Great American Songbook song, but it also is a true homage to jazz and blues.
Actually, you have really introduced me to Irving Berlin. I wasn't familiar with a lot of his work. And then the more I get into Irving Berlin, it's great. It's all great stuff. It's just great. And I hear a song and I think, gee, that's Irving Berlin, really? You know, so it's interesting, you know, how getting into more of the American Songbook has opened my mind. So thank you, Michael. I appreciate it.
Well, you're very welcome. I'm very excited because I'm going to accompany you. And this one is indeed by Irving Berlin, and it's called Harlem on My Mind.
Emeralds in my bracelets, diamonds in my rings, a Riviera chateau and a lot of other things, and I'm blue, so blue am I. Lots of red
ready money in 7 different banks. I counted up this morning, it's about 1,000,000 francs, and I'm blue, so blue, and I know why. I've got Harlem on my mind, and I'm longing to be low down. And my parlez-vous will not ring true with Harlem on my mind. I've been wined and I've been dined, but I'm heading for a showdown, and I can't go on till dawn with Harlem on my mind. I go to supper with a French marquis each evening after the show. My lips begin to whisper bon chéri, but my heart keeps singing. I become so darn refined, and at night I hate to go down to that highfalutin flat that Lady Mendel designed with Harlem on my mind. When I'm bathing in my marble tub each evening after the show, I get to thinking about that cotton club, and my heart starts jumping. Howdy ho, I become so damn refined, and at night
Irving Berlin, 1933, from S. Thousand's Cheer, Harlem on My Mind. You sing that beautifully.
Thank you. When we did the Ethel Waters tribute show.
Oh, at Lincoln Center, yeah.
At Lincoln Center, I quickly, you know, was really exploring and getting more deep into her vast catalog, her amazing catalog. Mm. So when I heard Harlem on My Mind, I thought, wait a second, this is fun. I love the lyric. What is she talking about? Lady Mendel, who's Lady Mendel? So it made me find out who Lady Mendel was.
Elsie DeWolf was her real name.
Yeah. And when I looked, you know, it just made me explore what the song was about. And then you told me that Ethel Waters was kind of making fun of Josephine Baker, so that when I sang the song, it had even more meaning, and I was able to just play with it and have fun with it.
Oh, yeah. Well, Ethel did not like Josephine Baker because she started her career in New York and Harlem, and then she went to Paris and became very, very French. She became more French than the French, and Ethel thought it was so pretentious, so this song was perfect.
Yeah. And so when I then the song became even more clear to me, you know. So it was really even more fun to inhabit.
It's interesting because Irving Berlin, in the 20s, there was a widespread rumor that he had, quote, a little colored boy who was writing the songs for him. I mean, it was among all the songwriters, they always talked about Irving Berlin's little colored boy. That's what they used to say.
Oh, my goodness.
And at one point, he hit a dry spell, and Harry Warren ran into Irving Berlin and said, Irving, what happened to your colored boy? And Irving said, he died. So even Irving knew about it.
Wow.
But no one could believe that Irving could have written all those songs. So he had to have somebody, especially when it came to the soulful things, they thought, oh, it had to be somebody else. Well, Ethel Waters is an example of someone whose repertoire really morphed through the years, because in the beginning she did very dirty, low-down jazz and blues songs, mm-hmm. the double entendre, and then she graduated to theater songs and very sophisticated songs. Tell me about your background.
Ooh, well, myself as a performer, or my family, or
well, your family, of course, is very important in your formation musically, I would think.
Yeah, I kind of grew up listening to a lot of different things. My parents exposed me to everything, so everything from opera to jazz to not a lot of blues, but to more rhythm and blues, to my father's music, to Louis Russell's big band music, to Louis Armstrong, to American Songbook, because we had a little radio in the kitchen. And that's how I heard all of these great artists that would then be on TV variety shows at night. So I really cherish that, you know, because these artists and these songs are not foreign to me. So I'm very happy that I grew up in that at that time. And then, I mean, I was just really trying to find myself in everything. How do I express myself because I like everything? What am I going to pick? So I started out in choirs in school, you know, as a voice major, because I love classical music and I didn't want to be the center of attention. So being in a choir was really a good way to do that, to hide, you know, with safety in numbers. And then I moved to California to kind of finish high school and go to college in the early 70s, and ran into gospel music, which I had never, I really was raised Presbyterian. I had no experience with that. Then, so that kind of opened up my voice and made me aware that, oh, I do have a kind of a big voice, which I didn't really know, but the choir director, Daryl Coley, at that point, gave me an opportunity to sing lead, you know, in the gospel choir. And
Were you scared?
Yes, I was terrified. He said, okay, today you're going to sing this song. And all of the people in the choir were like, how come, you know, looking at me like, how does she get to sing this? And you know, she's not even a Baptist, you know. And so people, I would say, have been very, very encouraging over the years. Then I went to singing in bands for private parties, which gave me the opportunity to sing a lot of these American Songbook tunes, you know, so in front of people. So that kind of expanded my song list in that way. And then you kind of go, well, how do I make a living? And I went from that band to singing the blues for a little while. I sang at Catch a Rising Star Comedy Club in the 80s in between comics.
That sounds like fun.
And that was singing blues and soul tunes, you know, so some Motown tunes. Mm. And then we do maybe a soul ballad in the middle. Everybody had 15-minute slots. So I was put in the what they call the check spot, which is that when the singer goes up there in between comics, they hand out the checks to the people. So the singer has to sing louder than the people talking about how much they owe. But that was great.
The best training, right?
The best training. Yeah. So, you know, it's easy sometimes, it's hard sometimes, and you learn from everything.
I had a chance to meet your mother, Carlene Ray. She played, what, bass and guitar? Did she play guitar?
Yes.
But she went to Juilliard.
She went to Juilliard. She started out as a concert piano major and then went to composition, changed her major to composition, graduated in 1946, went to the Manhattan School of Music as a voice major in the 50s. I was a baby at that point. She was a member of the International Sweethearts of Rhythm during the Second World War when a lot of men were at war. Then that was kind of the emergence of female instrumentalists as well as vocalists. And she was with that organization for maybe a year, a little more than that. She's worked with the Duke Ellington Orchestra under the direction of Mercer Ellington. She worked with the Cy Oliver Orchestra under the direction of Cy Oliver.
The best.
As a substitute bass player. So she was really the only female instrumentalist to work with that. I heard her actually with that orchestra. And Cy Oliver really liked her because she played what was on the page. She was a very specific kind of an arranger. Mm-hmm. So she didn't embellish anything. So actually, he started really, I think, to prefer her to the person whose job it originally was. She's worked with the great composer-arranger Mary Lou Williams and recorded Mary Lou's Mass with Mary Lou Williams and also did a tribute to Mary Lou Williams with the Lincoln Center Jazz Orchestra with Wynton Marsalis. Trombonist Melba Liston, she worked with Melba Liston for a while. Melba Liston worked with Quincy Jones. So
it goes on.
It really goes on.
Do you have recordings of her with any of the bands, any early things?
Well, not with the International Sweethearts, but these days, which is great, is that you can go on YouTube and see video of Mom playing. She was the guitarist in that band and sometimes vocalist, so you can actually go on YouTube and see her with this great swing orchestra.
Your father, I know, was musical director for Louis Armstrong. What exactly does that mean?
Basically, Louis Armstrong took over my father's orchestra in 1935. And so my dad took care of all the business with the musicians and also was the primary arranger from 1935 to 1941, really, you know. And so because Louis Armstrong, I guess, was notorious for not wanting to take care of any of the business. He just didn't. He wanted to play horn, and that was really it. He didn't want to mess with anything. And my dad was really good about keeping the organization, paying the people, the charts, the arrangements, you know, all of the grunt work that goes along with running a band. And that's what he loved to do because he ran his own orchestras before and after that. So he really won the Panamanian National Lottery in 1919, came to America. Yeah.
How much was that? How much?
It was $3,000.
Which is a lot of money back then.
It's a lot of money back then, you know. Yeah. And so he got on a boat with my grandmother and my aunt, went directly to New Orleans, started studying jazz and forming his bands then. So really, basically, a lot of the musicians that he worked with came out of New Orleans at that point, and they worked together for the rest of my dad's life and his musical life, definitely. So it's interesting. Yeah. So daddy retired from the music business in 1946 with the kind of the start of the decline of the big band.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That was the year right after the war. It all started to go away and singers became more important.
Yeah.
What is your estimation of Louis Armstrong as a vocalist?
I love his interpretation of lyric. I just think he can sing anything. And I believe him. I believe every word, you know. So whatever the state of his voice was in at any given time, I just love his interpretation of everything. He's also one of the greatest interpreters of lyric to me. And an example of that is they bring him, you know, I've read a few books on him now, and they brought him Mack the Knife. And he said, oh, I can sing this because it reminds me of people I grew up with. Yeah, who says that? That's, you know, Mack the Knife?
Pimps and murderers and...
Yeah. He said, oh, I know these people. You know, sure, I can sing this.
How about that?
And it was, you know, so everything they brought him, it, you know, he was successful as a crossover vocalist because of that, because he just believed what he was singing.
Hmm. And, of course, then there's Duke Ellington, who never sang. I have a private recording of him singing. And
of course you do.
Well, my friend Marshall Bear worked with him on his last Broadway show. And he has this recording of Duke singing, which I inherited. And
wow.
He was not a vocalist.
No.
He was everything else, but he was not that. Would you do something by Ellington?
Sure, sure. That will, we can do Mood Indigo.
Sure,
yeah. Which I love. I just love that song. It is a standard that really is so bluesy. It's really fun to sing because it's American song but blues at the same time.
Yeah, well, here it is, Mood Indigo. That's Duke Ellington's Mood Indigo. I say Duke Ellington, but Irving Mills' name is on so many of those songs. And Irving Mills was Duke Ellington's publisher and, by all accounts, had nothing to do with the composition of the songs. There was a joke that when Ellington died, the tombstone would say, "Here lies Duke Ellington and Irving Mills." You know, had to get a cut in, as they called it.
Even in death, right?
Who were some of the songwriters whose work that particularly resonate with you?
Harold Arlen. Oh, just love his sensibility. And I also love when he interprets his own songs, when he's singing his own songs, which,
yeah.
You know, you've actually let me hear a few of those examples. And I tell you, he sings with such passion, you really get all of what goes into the craft of writing. And I would say Duke Ellington. And, you know, Irving Berlin is coming up there in on my list. I'm telling you, that's, you know, it's beautiful. I'm just finding more and more things by him.
Well, you mentioned Arlen and Ellington. both who were performers in different ways. Arlen made a bunch of commercial records early in his career, and of course Ellington had his band to interpret his music.
Yes.
So it was a different kind of a thing. But it reminds me of Ray Noble, who was a British band leader who came to America and was known for his dance band.
Yeah.
And went on for a long time. But he also wrote music and lyrics.
Yeah, yeah. So I actually, this tune that I wanted to sing, I've heard since I was a child. And of late, though, the lyrics really resonate with me. I've heard it forever, you know. And the very thought of you just, the lyric is so beautiful. It's so simple, and it's so beautiful, and it's just about pure, unconditional love to me. And how the person that you're in love with makes you feel. It's just beautiful.
I love it too. I love the song, and I recorded it a few years ago, and
yes.
I'd love to do it with you. But
thank
you know, the
you.
Funny thing is that people rarely do the verse to the song.
Oh yeah.
Do you do it?
I don't yet, but I will. I should.
Well, can I sing the verse then?
Please.
We do it and
yes,
and
please
tackle it. Okay. Words and Music by Ray Noble. Our guest, Catherine Russell, and yours truly, performing The Very Thought of You. I don't need your photograph to keep by my bed. Your picture is always in my head. I don't need your portrait, dear, to call you to mind. For sleeping or waking, dear, I find
the very thought of you and I forget to do the little ordinary things that everyone ought to do. Thought of you, my love. It's just the thought of you, the very thought of you. My love.
The very thought of you, beautifully sung by Catherine Russell. There's more coming up in a moment with our guest. And our program is made possible in part by NPR and the National Endowment for the Arts, ArtWorks. I'm Michael Feinstein, and this is Song Travels from NPR Music. Catherine, when I accompany you, it's so gratifying for me because I love the way you phrase, and I feel like I'm right with you. And, you know, you have so much experience in music because I know that you were for many years a backup singer, and I don't think people really understand what is involved in that. It's a very difficult thing to do, isn't it?
It's a different set of skills completely than lead singing. I think the greatest belief among people is that you sing backup until you're a lead singer, you know, which is definitely not the case. It's a completely different job. And I started out singing harmony when I was young because I just love singing harmony with people. You know, it just makes me happy. And so I ended up in choirs and different things. And it was a good way for me as a young adult to break into working in the music business. You know, that's how I really started, singing backup, doing song demos for people and doing all the vocals.
Ever do commercials?
Yeah, I did commercials. I did a lot of jingles over the years.
Make a lot of money?
And I don't know about a lot of money, but I made very good money for several years. You know, it was very nice. And that's also another set of skills to record jingles, which I learned. And harmony singing is really so much about listening and blending with the voices that you're singing with. So it's a different way of using the voice rather than unbridled, you know, lead singing, or you're interpreting the lyric. You are really like a horn section. You are really supporting the lead singer. So everything that you're doing is in support.
And you have to blend with each other.
You have to blend with each other. You have to start notes and end notes at the same time. You have to sometimes the note is breathier than other times. Sometimes it's fuller than other times. And so you really, it's really listening to the musicians, the orchestra that you're working with, as well as knowing the tone of the singers that you're with. There is a lot that does go into it. And I'm so happy to work with so many people in New York that are so skilled at that. So I've really learned from the best over the years.
It's interesting because I've known a lot of singers who cannot sing harmony.
Yeah.
Rosemary Clooney could never sing harmony. Marilyn May, with whom I recently worked, is a great, great singer. She can't easily sing harmony. Judy Holliday, who was on Broadway in Bells Are Ringing, also had an incredible film career, couldn't sing harmony. And when Julie Stein wanted her to sing a counter melody to The Party's Over, he taught her the counter melody as the melody she was supposed to sing.
Mm-hmm.
And then she learned it.
Right, right. Yeah, Phoebe Snow also.
Really?
God bless her. Could
oh,
not.
Boy.
Was not a backup singer. She just didn't get the concept of, I'm supporting someone else, because she was such a powerful lead singer. you know. So it was interesting, you know, because I have done a few shows with her where we were in a backup section together. Hmm. And trying to remember a part. This is the other thing, is that you have to actually remember parts. You have to remember what goes here and what goes there and do it the same each time.
Oh, yeah.
You know?
And things evolve, too, I imagine.
Yeah, they evolve depending on how we're going to do it tonight as opposed to how we did it last night. Maybe the venue is different. Maybe you're singing in a different theater, so every night you're in a different place singing acoustically. Things are going to be slightly different.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a lot of joy in that when the star is comfortable because that person knows that they're going to be taken care of by his backup singers or her backup singers. It's very gratifying.
How do you feel about Billie Holiday?
I have actually learned to appreciate Billie Holiday's style a lot more in recent years. Early on when I was listening to her, I liked the sound of her voice, but I was always looking for a melody, you know, and just thinking, I know there's a melody there, and I really want to know how the song goes.
Mm-hmm.
But I think lately I've really gotten more into her style and her phrasing, and also I read her biography and then learned more about how she was influenced by Louis Armstrong's phrasing and so forth and so on. So really when I heard I Cover the Waterfront, her version was the first version of that song that I heard, and that's what inspired me to sing it.
Well, no offense to Billie Holiday, but I would love to hear you sing it right now.
Okay, thank you.
Here we go, I Cover the Waterfront, sung by Catherine Russell.
Away from a city that hurts and knocks, I'm standing alone by the desolate docks. In the still and the chill of the night, I see the horizon, that great unknown. My heart has an ache, it's as heavy as stone. Will the dawn come in? Soon come back to
I cover the waterfront, Johnny Green and Edward Heyman. I was very good friends with Johnny, who composed that music, and I think of him all the time. He's one of those people I think of every day.
Wow.
He was a great, great pianist, and he wrote that song after a movie came out called I Cover the Waterfront that was so popular that he wrote what they called an exploitation song about it.
Okay.
They may have actually put it in the movie later, but originally it wasn't from it, and that starred Claudette Colbert, with whom Johnny had an affair at the time. So I wonder if
all
there's a little bit of
back
her.
To...
Yeah, it all goes back to the same thing, doesn't it? Well, I'd like to take a lyric that we've heard a million times and hear how you do it, because you do make songs fresh for me.
Thank you.
I Can't Give You Anything But Love. That's probably one of the most requested songs, one of the most recorded songs. And I'd like to do a middle section that I learned from a 1932 Ethel Waters recording that's a counter melody.
Oh.
So maybe we could give this a go. I guess it's an instant duet, if you don't mind.
Okay, that's great.
Jimmy McHugh and Dorothy Fields.
Rome wasn't built in a day, kid. You have to pay, kid, for what you get. But I am willing to wait, dear. Your little mate, dear, will not forget. You have a lifetime before you. I'll adore you, come what may. Please don't be blue for the present, when it's so pleasant to hear you say. I can't give you anything but love, baby. That's the only thing I've plenty of. Dream a while, scheme a while, you're sure to find happiness, and I guess all those things you've always pined for. Gee, I'd like to see you looking swell. Oh, baby, diamond bracelets Woolworth does not sell. No, baby, till that lucky day, you know darn well, baby, I can't give you anything but love.
And when I take her in my arms and whisper, I love you, to have her near me just to cheer me, how could I be blue? Deep in my heart, oh, I get such a thrill. We'll never part, that I know we never will. For love we'll find a way. Never fear, there'll come a time, maybe, my dear. So we'll wait, trust fate, that we'll be happy sometime with that precious little thing called love.
Oh, gee, I'd like to see you looking swell. Baby, diamond bracelets Woolworth does not sell. Baby, till that lucky day, you know darn well.
That was fun.
Yeah.
I Can't Give You Anything But Love. There was a whole rumor that Fats Waller wrote that. You know, there's a big scandal.
Yeah.
Still, people say that he wrote it. But I met Adelaide Hall, who knew Fats very, very well. And she said that Fats categorically told her that he did not write it.
Okay.
So I'm the last to tell you that, probably. but there we go. Thus far, you've recorded 4 CDs, and they're all delicious, and I love the accompaniment on them. I love the sensibility. They feel They feel casual and they sound fresh. They sound live and alive.
Thank you.
How do you decide how you're going to record? Are your recordings different from the instruments you use in a live performance, or is it similar?
They're just expanded versions of what we do live. So the touring unit is generally three people, bass, piano, and guitar. And those three people also do the albums with me. My guitarist, Matt Munisteri, is the musical director, so he does a lot of the arranging. He runs the recording sessions. So what we do, I always think about how the live show is going to compare with the album, or, you know, how I'm going to do that. So we basically do a lot of pre-production work. I'll introduce songs months before I'm going to record them, just to see how they land and see if people like them, you know. And then we will get everything together and get our scheduling together and go in for 3 days and set up in a circle in the studio and play everything live. And then if people need to fix something, then we fix. But we go in with the intention of live playing, so that people are inspired by one another. And I figure if all of the people that I admire did that, you know, if everybody that I love went in live and just recorded,
yes,
I should aspire to that too. So I try to get, I'm definitely not a one-take vocalist, but that's the sensibility. That's how I do all of my recording, because it's just better for me. Don't let me nitpick something, because then we'll end up taking a year to get a product out, you know.
And some people do. That's the danger of recording.
Yeah.
From your newest CD, Strictly Romancin', what would you like to play so people can hear what it sounds like?
Well, I did kind of a duet with John Allred, who plays trombone on this album. So we did a Billy Strayhorn, Duke Ellington tune called I'm Checking Out Goombye. And I actually heard the original Ivy Anderson version, and I thought, well, this is fun. So we went in and we had a really good time doing it.
Okay, well, here it is. I'm checking out Goombye.
Hello? Hello? Is this Harlem 77711? Hello, John? Is this you? I tried to phone you. I hope you ain't sick. But I'm checking out Goombye. Nice to have known you. You were my big kick. But I'm checking out Goombye. You tried no trick. You found a new chick. But I was too slick. I'm in the know. You got to go. The cake is all dough. It's too bad. Our bliss had to miss out like this. I'm checking out Goombye. John? Huh? Oh, no, 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 you're breaking up, baby.
It's a very tongue-in-cheek and delightful performance of I'm Checking Out Goombye. Catherine Russell, that's really something fun. I know the recording that Rosemary Clooney made with Ellington later.
Okay.
So the song certainly wears well.
Yeah, I'll have to hear that. I haven't heard that.
I'll get it for you.
Yeah.
What would you like to sing as the last statement on the program today?
The Jimmy McHugh, Dorothy Fields tune, I'm in the Mood for Love. Actually, I was listening to Louis Armstrong's version of this song, and it reminded me how much I liked it. And this is another one that I've heard all my life. And the lyric is beautiful. I'm in the mood for love simply because you're near me. That's gorgeous. I don't know. It just reminds me of a simpler time when people were dancing to orchestras on the dance floor. And it's just simple romance is what I love. So it's just a beautiful song. I'd love to do it.
It's my pleasure to play it for you. Catherine Russell, who's in the mood for love.
Lovely interlude, most romantic mood, and your attitude is right, dear. Sweetheart, you've got me under your spell. Now my dream is real. This is why I feel such a strong appeal tonight. Somehow, all my reason takes flight, dear. Simply because you're near me. Funny, but when you're near me, I'm in the mood for love. Heaven is in your eyes, bright as the stars we're under. Oh, is it any wonder I'm in the mood for love? Why stop to think of weather? This little dream might fade. We put our hearts together. Stop to think of weather. This little dream might fade. We put our hearts together. Rain, we'll let it, but
Catherine Russell, you sing that lusciously.
Thank you so much for your beautiful accompaniment.
And thank you, too, for being a marvelous guest on Song Travels.
I appreciate it. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
This has been Song Travels with host Michael Feinstein and his guest, Catherine Russell. Song Travels is a production of South Carolina ETV Radio and is recorded at Hearst Studios in New York City, with post-production in the Elaine T. Friedman Suite at ETV Radio in Columbia, South Carolina. The producer is Sherry Hutchinson, recording engineer Duke Marcos, assistant recording engineer Andrew Shire, mastering engineer David Mitchell, production manager Grant Jackson, production assistant Laura Hunsberger. The executive producer is Kobe Hennessy. The executive in charge is Linda O'Brien. Special thanks to Anya Grundman, director and executive producer of NPR Music. We love to hear from you. Our email address is songtravels@scetv.org. Support for Song Travels comes from NPR and the National Endowment for the Arts, ArtWorks. Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and NPR contributors, which include the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives, at gatesfoundation.org. And the Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for improving education and enrichment for children both in and out of school, at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR.